So I guess it's a great pleasure to introduce Carolina. Carolina did undergraduate at La Molina in Lima in Peru, and also worked there for a while, and then did her master's in Amsterdam, and then came here for her DPhil, and since then has been working at Q, and she'll describe her work on anti-biodiversity and its response to climate change. So, Carolina.
I'd like to thank both Ravinder and Jane for the invitation. I'm working at the Biodiversity Informatics and Spatial Analysis Department at Kew Gardens. And
I'm just going to write
more now.
Yes, I'm going to write a PC right.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. I'm going to present the work that I've been doing in Kew for the last 3 years, which is about tropical annual biodiversity in response or in relation to climate change. But just briefly, let me introduce a bit of the big overarching question that I have on my research. So I'm interested on how our species distribution and species assemblages are shaped by environmental changes, but also key processes. So in the last 15 years, I've been working mostly on understanding biodiversity responses to climate change, fragmentation, land use change. And it's only in the last 3 years that I've been more interested in incorporating some other important processes, like dispersal, but also evolutionary history. And these two components, I think, are key in order to get or improve our assessment of risk and vulnerability of biodiversity, that in turn can contribute to provide conservation management and improving also people's livelihoods. So this is the overarching, the overview of my research. And today, I'm going to talk about the tropical Andean grasslands, a very brief overview about them. But I'm going to focus particularly in vulnerability and resilience to climate change from the point of view of thermal niche traits, which are thermal tolerances, but also another key important process, which is dispersal. And I'm briefly going to mention at the end it's some work that we've been doing about evaluating potential climate change impact on useful plants and ecosystem services. So let's start with the tropical Andean grasslands. So the tropical Andes, as most of you know, are located in South America. So this mountain range is the second highest in the world, and it ranges from more or less 700 to up to more than 6,000 meters above sea level. And we have different biomes in these areas, tropical Andes. And today I'm going to focus on these biomes that we call the grasslands. We have different kind of grasslands. I'm just going to briefly describe three of them. The ones in orange that you can see are the páramo, located near the equatorial area, and those are have really high precipitation, and also they are less seasonal, because so annually the temperature doesn't fluctuate much. Well, then we have the puna here in brown, this puna, the humid puna, and the xeric puna, which have a little bit more seasonality over the year, and also is much drier. Okay? So today we're going to talk about these grasslands, these three grasslands, and there's a history that we have to take into account in terms of the changes this biodiversity has been subjected to. In the long-term history of this area, we have observed changes due to climate, past climate. Like if we see, for example, in this study that they show the present-day location of this lake that has been studied, that is located in green area now in mountain forest, around between 2,000 and 3,000. If we see how it was 21,000 years ago, during the last glacial maximum, we see that it was surrounded by then by grass páramo and subpáramo here in yellow. So there has been a fluctuation in elevation due to this climate change. This is a long term, 21,000 years ago, and it also has consequences in how forest land has shifted. And we can see here in present, let's say the warmer conditions nowadays. You can see the alpine biomes here in the top of the mountains, and if you see it from the top view, you can see they are disconnected. During cooler conditions, they go down the mountains, and from the top view, you can see they are connected, right? And this has profound implications in different processes that shape biodiversity in these regions. If we talk about short-term changes, we can go back to the work that was done by Humboldt back in 1800s, when he climbed the Chimborazo and made explorations and record the vegetation in these regions, and described very briefly with this nice graph, the upper vegetation limit was located at 4,600 meters above sea level. And 200 years after, in 2012, a group of researchers went back and redid the survey, the vegetation survey in that area. And what they discovered and tried to mimic that graph that it was done by Humboldt 200 years ago, and discovered that the upper vegetation limit was 5,100 meters above sea level. So this upper displacement occurred in 200 years. That has been shown also, there's plenty of evidence that this is a common pattern in different mountains worldwide, and also for different taxa. So now, why is this important not only for biodiversity, this climate change impact that is observed already in vegetation, but also to people, because in this area, there are several people depending on many ecosystem services, most notably water. This Paramo, principally in the north, in the northern Andes, provide or store water in the areas that provide drinking water and water for agriculture for several millions of people in Medellin, Quito, and Bogota. And also several of these regions have a heavy use of plants for medicinal purposes. They are registered in several publications in Spanish. So in this context, there is a group of people that have formed the initiative Gloria Andes. And this is a group of researchers South American researchers that have installed permanent vegetation plots that go from Venezuela, northern Venezuela, to northern Argentina. There are 49 vegetation summits, 49 communities, where they have recorded vegetation cover and also climate, temperature, and humidity between 2012 and 2013. And the idea is to resurvey these areas every 5 years with the aim of observing what are the potential changes in species composition. And in this group, there are several people involved, and different institutions as well from South America, and they have published already some work. And the idea is to use this data. What I'm going to present now today is mostly based on the results of this analysis and surveys. So we're going to start with this. The first point where I'm going to show the information about thermal need traits and how we can use that for improve our vulnerability assessment to climate change. So in this work is led by Francisco Cuesta, which is a leading biodiversity section in an Ecuadorian NGO, where we are trying to test is the effect of temperature changes along the latitudinal gradient on the thermal niche traits of the species and communities. So both are the two objectives. Because, as you can see here, this is a graph obtained from using the different temperatures of plots. If this is the equator, the farther we go from the equator, from 0 to 20 north or south, the niche breadth of the temperature register maximum and minimum increases. As we go farther from the equator. So near the equator, we have more or less 10 degrees difference between minimum and maximum temperature, and that this could be like between minus 10 and 15 in areas in the south, for example. And what we expect is this: if this is happening, measure the temperature, temperature air, that species will have more or less these kind of ranges, right? So these are species located near the equator, and the community average of these species would be a little bit narrow. And then the ones that are located farther from the equator will have larger thermal tolerances. So that's the hypothesis we want to test in here. And how we did that, we collect information for species occurrences for 507 species. This is the total number of identified species on those summits, more than 500. And we collected nearly 26,000 occurrences using different sources, GBIF, Tropical, Cervaria, and Gloria. We heavily cleaned this data set because they were 25% of the records that were not totally useless. And then we extracted the temperature, the monthly mean temperature for each location from a working data set that was downscaled to 90 meters. And in here, what we wanted to build was a kind of histogram for each species, right? So this species has a number of occurrences, in this case 12, and then you can estimate, like, for example, the optimum temperature would be like where this peak is, so that would be something like 8 degrees, and then it would be between 5 and 10, so it has a narrow breadth, thermal niche breadth, while these species have a very broad thermal breadth, right? So we were interested in measuring the thermal optimum, represented by the middle point, the highest point, the minimum by the minimum temperature, and the thermal niche breadth. So we estimated this for each species. But then we also, for those 500 species, what we observed was that there were several groups that we can identify according to the distribution they have. So all of them were recorded in these summits, but some of them were endemic to the Paramo, so only present in this part of the, above the tree line, but in this part of the, that's from 0, from 6 degrees south to 12 degrees north. Otherwise, other were endemic to the Puna, in this area. Other species were present in both of them, tropical and alpine. Others were, the distribution goes south to Patagonia. And others were present above and below tree line, which is the tropical mountain, the neotropical, and the cosmopolitan, that were species present here. There were 8 species that were that come from Europe or other places outside America. So the first thing we made was to try to compare what the thermal niche traits, so these TNTs, for these biogeographic groups. So we just grouped the species. Because we are because the Paramo endemic is limited to that part of the equator, we were expecting that it was like having the lower thermal niche breadth. And we can see here the letters indicate significant differences. And then we can really see that the net, as an average, or the median value of a thermal niche breadth of Paramo endemic is 8 degrees, for example, here, and it's significantly different from the one in Puna and the other of the other biogeographic groups. So we do see kind of a gradient for this species group along the latitudinal gradient. So potential explanations for this, there are, for example, higher degree of fragmentation in the northern part, in the northern Andes. So we can expect that species are more able to disperse to other patches, and then therefore they stay in their main habitat. There is also the absence of seasonality, that we said that the annual temperature seasonality in the northern Andes is really narrow. And it's also related to there is a recent uplift. This area of the Andes in the north, close to the equator, has recently suffered uplift, which means the species could be still expanding their niche. If we plot these in the space, those are the 507 species plotted in the x-axis, we can see the thermal optimum of the species. This is logarithm. And then the niche breadth in this area. Right, so this is more or less like the midpoint is 12 degrees for the thermal niche breadth and 7 degrees for the thermal optimum. And we classify the species based on these squares by the ones that have lower thermal optimum and lower niche breadth located in this quadrant are potentially the ones that have higher vulnerability to climate change, because those are the ones that are going to have having a narrow thermal niche breadth. With increased temperature, you will have less potential suitable temperatures to be able to survive in. On the contrary, this area, the species that have the higher values of thermal optimum plus higher, broader thermal niches, have low vulnerability. So we can classify the species in this group and see, analyze briefly how they could be vulnerable or resilient as well to this climate change. Now, if we group things by community, and then try to analyze. The interesting thing here to see is that, for example, these are the Paramo communities, the ones that are in the north and near the equator. And in pink are the species the species composition based on these biogeographic groups. Pink is the Paramo endemic, and Puna endemic are the ones in light turquoise. Is it called? Turquoise or light blue? So we can see the Paramo communities have a very varied composition. We were not expecting this. We thought most of them would be like Paramo endemics, but we see a heavy component here of purple, which is the tropical Andean alpine, and also the tropical mountain species. And, well, in contrast, the communities in the Puna, which are farther south in the from the equator, have a very high number of Puna endemics. So that's the first difference. And then after that, what we did was to try to analyze for all the communities, the 49 communities, their relationship with the latitude, which was our hypothesis. And for the breadth, for example, we see like the farther the equator, the higher the niche breadth. So we summarize all the species belonging to one community in one value. Right? So summarizing using a weighted mean of all the thermal niche traits for each species. So these are 49 points. So we see a positive relation. The higher, the farther from equator, the higher the niche breadth. But also it's a slight, we can't not see it properly here, but because we run a mixed model here, and there is a negative relation with elevation, but it's very marginal. While as expected, optimum temperature is correlated with elevation. Here is elevation, so the higher the elevation, the lower the elevation, the higher the temperature, the minimum and the minimum. So this is the one that supports our hypothesis. And at the end, what we did was also to analyze the vulnerability per community, which is based on the analysis we did per the species. Remember, we assigned a category like low, medium, and high vulnerability. So we did the same for communities. And in this case, what we see clearly in red are the communities that had high vulnerability. And in the Paramount, near the north area of the Andes, we see the higher vulnerability. So this is an example of how we were using these thermal niche traits to assess vulnerability and resilience of this area in the communities. Now, once we observe the changes in tolerance, thermal tolerances, we could say, okay, this species is more vulnerable or not. But there is another factor to take into account in these in mountain regions, which is the plant dispersal strategies. Because these areas are naturally highly fragmented, you can see the mountains to reach from one area to the other area, the other patch or suitable patch is really challenging for this species. But besides these naturally fragmented conditions, what we have is human impact and land use change. So this is just briefly to show you a study that they made in north of Peru, in Cajamarca. And all the green areas, the grasslands in that area, Alpine, the Andean grasslands, in 1987, and by 2007, 20 years later, 25% of those grasslands were lost. So that was only 20 years, and causing or leading to even more fragmentation. So the question here is, how these species disperse, and how are they going to be vulnerable by this limited dispersal? So these species have several dispersal strategies. There are different adaptations that they can use to move from one patch to the other and continue surviving in different areas. We can see, for example, that some of them develop hairy appendages or papus, so they disperse by wind, which is known as an mockery. Other ones develop hooks or bristles to be attached to animals, and they are transported by an episoochory on the animal fur. Other ones invest in producing edible fruits that are transported by animals by eating them, so endozoochory. Other ones produce explosive fruits, so they don't move or they don't produce anything that makes them move, but they are ejected from the plant, from the flower, the seeds are ejected. And finally, the ones that do not have any particular adaptation, so they are just dispersed by gravity, and that's that we know as baroquery. So in this work, what we did was to try to answer three different questions. One is like, what is the dominant dispersal mode in this region? Normally, most of the other mountains in the world is an anemochory is a dominant dispersal syndrome. It's by wind. The other question was, how is the effect or the role of environment versus evolutionary history? So how can we see what is more important in driving these dispersal strategies in the Andes? And our hypothesis here is that the conditions are really hard in the high Andes, so that the environmental filter will prevail over this evolutionary history. And the third question is, what is the level of vulnerability due to dispersal, limited dispersal for these species? In order to analyze or to answer these questions, we needed to collect four different types of data, four different matrices. One, the community data, so the sites or communities and the species that are present in each of the sites. The environmental data, which are for each of the sites or communities, what is the type of climate we have, each of the environmental variables we're interested in. And then trait data, so we have species and the traits for each of the species. And finally, phylogenetic data, so how species, the distance between species in phylogenetic level, so how closely or differently related they are in between these 500 species. once we have the data, we have to collect the traits. And this was a bit, that proved really challenging, because we have to collect the dispersal mode based on morphological adaptations to know if they disperse by wind, by animals, etc. But also life form, because life form is related, it's directly related to the distance the species will disperse. So taller plants or trees will have a farther dispersal than shrubs and herbs. So that's another trait that influences the dispersal of these species. So I went and collect data from different herbarium in South America, in Kew, but the main problem with that is that most herbariums keep specimens that are in flower, because that's what is useful for identification. So not many of them kept information or specimens with fruits. But even though I managed to collect some information from there, also from that some databases, but very few species from the Andes are in those databases. And finally, the last resource was a literature review. It turns out some of the times I had to go and read the description of the species just to see how whether there were certain appendages of morphological adaptations that were described by the person that described the species. Phylogenetic data, that was also very challenging. We used a mega phylogeny downloaded from the BN website, but 23% of those species, of my species, were not in that phylogeny tree. So I was working this with Untaro Kusumoto, which is a visitor researcher at Kew, and he grafted this species using taxonomy into this phylogenetic tree, which was also another issue we have in the Andes. There's not much information about this. For the first question, what is the dominant dispersal syndrome? We found out an agreement with other areas in the world that Anemochori, 200 species or 43% of the species have dispersal by wind, but also 34% more or less didn't have any special adaptation to disperse in this area, so they just disperse by gravity. Other species have the Epizoochori, only 40 of the species of 9% more or less produce edible fruits to be dispersed by animals. And in terms of life form, the dominant syndrome was herbs, shrubs, and very few trees. So this is at the level of species, there are 500 species. But if we see that distribution of the different traits among the communities, we can see there is a variation of syndrome. This is only for the dispersal modes. So we have here, for example, these communities have equal value for Anemochori and Barochori, but here the variation is as well, although there seems to be a little bit more predominance of Anemochori dispersal by winds in the Puna region, which is in the south. If we make an average, as an average, a community normally has 50% of their species that they disperse by wind, so by far, again, the dominant syndrome per community, and followed by the 25% of the species by Barochori, so no adaptation. And in terms of life form, it's herb, the dominant one. But that was expected. So then the question was, again, how do we decouple the effect of environment and determining these dispersal syndromes versus their evolutionary history? So we use RLQ ordination analysis, in which we use these four matrices I described before, environment, community, trait, and phylogeny. And analyze how related were these trait states with the environment. And this is an ordination plot. We first organize the environmental variables. This is correlation with the first axis. And we can see that on the left, we have higher minimum temperatures, higher maximum temperatures, a little bit higher precipitation in this side. While in the right, would be the opposite. And we can organize as well the traits using this analysis. And these are the coordinates on the first axis. And we can clearly see that endosulfury, edible fruits, and be a tree and shrub, coincides with having a higher minimum and maximum temperatures, which was also expected. But in the other part of the spectrum, having lower temperature, lower precipitation, leads to a species to have more this, not develop any adaptation, which is Barochori, and being predominantly herbs. Epizoochori is also in this side. But Anemochori, wind dispersal, doesn't seem to have any relationship with the environment. And if we can compare also with the phylogeny here, we can also see this division in the first axis, and the ones in the right in black most likely are related to these traits, and the ones on the left are related to the negative side of this panel. And we see for some species or some groups of species that have certain predominant traits, and that certain groups are related to these traits. Poaceae, for example, having not do not ha- doesn't have adaptations, specific adaptations for dispersal, and are mostly herds. Also, this Caryophyllalis group is mostly dispersed by gravity, so no adaptations. Well, in Asteraceae we have this mixed signal because these, some of these species, although most of them have anemochory dispersal, some of them are herds, other ones are shrubs. So, and we have herds in this side and shrubs in this area. So with this graph, we are trying to represent different variation in the data and how they relate between environment, traits, and phylogeny. So then we wanted to know how much, how could you explain at the same time environment conditions and, evolutionary history for the percentage of a specific trait state in a community. So for example, here, Barocori. So this would be, this box represents the percentage of Barocori in that community, and we would like to explain that by environmental conditions, in this case temperature and precipitation, but then also we need to correlate to account for species richness and for phylogenetic species variation. So the lower the phylogenetic species variation means that species are more similarly phylogenetically speaking, and the higher value is that they are more different phylogenetically speaking. So we run this for each of the trait states, each of the dispersal syndromes, and each for the of the life form. And this is a summary for the dispersal. So we did find a correlation for environment, for endozoochory, hydrochory, this is dispersed by water, and barochory, and also phylogenetic signal for epizoochory, endozoochory, and barochory. So that means that both components are important in determining these dispersal syndromes. However, for anemochory, we didn't find any relationship with either of the two components we were exploring. While in the case of life form, it was clearly that the main driver here is environmental. So most of them are related to either precipitation or temperature, and only herds were a little bit related with the phylogenetic structure of the community. So these are the summary of how we can see the influence of environment versus evolutionary history here. So as a summary of this, what we found is a gradient of within the tropical alpine grassland. Okay, there are areas within the tropical alpine grasslands that are a little bit warmer, like in the lower regions, and the minimum temperatures in the harshest parts. And this, in this environmental gradient, it seems to be that the traits that we are finding in the extremes of our analysis, we have barochory here, which doesn't involve any investment in plants and in special adaptations, and endozoochory in the other extreme, represent a plant investment gradient. So plants invest more, obviously, in areas that are warmer and with a little bit more precipitation, and develop these edible fruits and shrubs, and there can be shrubs or trees, while in the other, in the areas that are colder, we have no specific adaptations and herbs. And this can also, at the same time, be related with certain groups of species, of plant species, certain families here, or groups, orders. However, anemochory, which is a dispersal syndrome, the dispersed by wind, is in the middle. So it doesn't seem to be affected either by the environmental variables or some of the evolutionary history. And the two families, the two most abundant families, Asteraceae and Poaceae, that cover more or less 45% of the total of the species, have Asteraceae has more anemochory, and then Poaceae only a bit, not that much. But it could be here that there are other useful traits that are allowing these species to survive in this area that are not affected by this environmental gradient, for example, soil or something like that. So the question here is, like, what is going to happen with climate change? Once we know this, what is the immediate consequence after we observe this? Well, we could propose that under climate change scenarios, those species that have these edible fruits that are in warmer regions now in the tropical Andes will gain space and going to the area, new areas that would be warmer and were formerly colder. And there are certain studies that are showing slowly this transition, that there is increase in the number of the abundance of the species that have edible fruits now going upwards. So the third question was related to the dispersal distances. how can we measure this? In an ideal world, obviously, we could construct a very beautiful cure with different individuals. We throw a seed in a big wind tunnel, for example, and measure how far they can go. And we construct this and have a range between 0 and 300. But that's in an ideal world. And in South America, there have been some different difficulties to collect this kind of information. There's a lack of empirical information for dispersal. So what is the other option? There's a recent paper by Tom Tame that he published in 2014, when he collected a very large amount of information of dispersal distances that were actually measured in the field, and also collected traits of these different species to compare whether he could predict the dispersal distances based on these traits. And he found a decent regression explaining these observed maximum dispersal distances and the ones that were modeled using certain traits. So the traits he used to model these dispersal distances were dispersal syndrome, the dispersal mode, growth form, seed mass, seed release height, and terminal velocity. And he could even showed that even having those two only could be useful to estimate these maximum dispersal distances. So we decided to collect a little bit more of information. So our master's student in Amsterdam collected as much information as we could for seed mass and seed release height, but we used the plant height as a surrogate of this, to really run these models for most of the species where we can. So we can run different models, and we try to complete the full model for most of the species. And I'm just going to show you briefly some of the results. This is just really plotted yesterday. So this needs a little bit more of analysis. And what we found clearly is that these are the maximum dispersal categories. So 25% of the species, or near 100, disperse less than 1 meter. So these are really vulnerable species in this region. But most of them, these first three columns, are dispersed less than 100 meters. So these ones disperse between 10 and 100. And very few go over a kilometer. So there's a real limited dispersal for these species. And if we plot this in the community level, again, we aggregate like the minimum dispersal distance for each of the community. This is in Spanish. It should be elevation. Okay. So this is between 0 and 300 meters is the mean dispersal distance. And this is the elevation. And what we can see is the species located in the higher communities are the ones that will disperse really, really very few meters, using only the mean. As I said, these are preliminary results, and we need to work a little bit more on that. But these are part of the analysis that we are running at the moment. Also with minimum temperatures and maximum temperatures, this I'm not really sure about this, I will have to test. But there is a correlation with elevation, which poses a risk because we also found that some of the species that are located in the upper regions are also limited by the thermal niche traits that they have. So I've been showing now what is the vulnerability and resilience of the species due to climate change using thermal niche ranges, that's one thing, but also limited dispersal with the functional traits I'll show you. But there is another work that I'm not going to show now. When we evaluate for these species, we analyze the distribution of these species and the niche based on of different variables. And what is the risk due to niche position? Are they in the extreme range of the niche or in the middle of their niche? And the idea is after that to use specific groups to analyze and make a full assessment, for example, of useful plants. We had a summer student last summer where they were collecting information about how, of those 500 species, how many were used by people. And nearly 25% so far have a kind of use, but we still need to do a little bit more of work about that. And also the next step would be to start analyzing the changes in the species composition and which ones are decreasing in abundance, which ones are increasing in abundance, and compare with our vulnerability analysis based on thermal niche and dispersal. So those are the future steps for the following years. And the last part of the talk, I'm going to briefly, really briefly show you a work that we did at Kew with Newton Fund in the Colombia Paramount. So the work we did the title of the proposal was Plants for Life. So we wanted to evaluate the impact of climate change on important plants for ecosystem services in Boyacá, which is a province of Colombia. The idea of this work was to work in this is Colombia, so in the northeast of Colombia, in the eastern Cordillera, in this area. The idea was to identify plants that were useful for people and then try to link them to certain ecosystem services. For example, this chilco, this Baccharis, is used for soil protection, so that's the ecosystem service regulation. And we try also to identify certain traits, but yeah, that was a little bit more tricky. Like, for example, this was an association with mycorrhiza. Another species, for example, that have two different uses, one for slope protection, so it was regulation, but also it had medicinal use, so it was also a provision ecosystem service. So this was the logic we follow for the work. And we collected data from different literature reviews, but also we went field work, we collect information from people and some of the markets in Boyacá. And what we did was again to create a database of useful plants that were linked to ecosystem services, and then select those species which main habitat was in Boyacá, that was the main habitat was the páramo, at least have a number of points to model distributions and where the taxonomy was well defined. And we selected 100 species and performed niche modeling using Mahalanobis distance. And the first result that we found is that from those 100 species, we found several uses for several plants in that group. But most of them, 75 more or less, have any medicinal use. So this was the most popular use, let's say. Then we have material, restoration, barriers, etc. And you can see the categories here in color, like cultural, provision, regulating, and supporting. But also, the other thing that we found is that there are some species, most of the species provide one ecosystem service here, like 40 of them providing only one. But there were other group of species that provide at the same time several ecosystem services. And that's important because we can focus on some of them that can provide, that can be useful for people in different aspects. And at the end, just this is a summary, we performed the models, we ran the models, and we combined the distribution models of the different species, and we projected to the future and analyzed which ones will be changing into the area. This is the distribution of Boyacá, so in red, those areas that will be lost, mostly, and these areas that will gain a bit, or the suitability will increase, and areas in red, the suitability in which will decrease. So, for example, we have here 25 species that were identified useful for restoration were combined in this map. In here, medicinal, these 86 species were combined to do this medicinal map, and most of the areas, as you can see, are in red. So they are showing that these ecosystem services most likely will have decreased in area. So some of the conclusions is like the overall trend for these ecosystem services is a decline, is a negative. But there are projected changes in these areas like this. There are some dispersal opportunities there, population persistence, but also extirpation of certain regions. And also in here we use a Mahalanobis distance, which is a metric that only takes into account that when models are performed, only use a presences of species. So most of the models that we use for the species distribution model needs presence and absences. And in this case, we decided to go for a metric that only considers for the presences of the species and deals with it, because we are talking about people here and useful plants, which is a more delicate matter than only project biodiversity that do not have and specific use for people in this case. And lastly, well, this is the people that work with me in this project. And lastly, I would just would like to mention that I attended one of these Newton Fund workshops that I don't know if you have heard of those. These are funded by the British Council and the UK government to have an integration of different people working in South America. And we were working in this case, this workshop was Plant Dynamics and Climate Change in the Andes. And this was organized by Royal Botanic Garden Edinburgh, led by Pete Collinsworth, and South America from Ricardo Villalba from CONICET. And the idea was to put together this group of people to discuss during 3 or 4 days what are the issues and the opportunities and challenges of working with plant dynamics and climate change in the Andes. So at the moment, we are working in three different groups, trying to write a synthesis and reviews of knowledge gaps in the tropical Andes in terms of biodiversity, well, not tropical Andes, the whole Andes, knowledge gaps. The other one is about ecosystem services and climate change. And the last one is about what are the challenges and opportunities of modeling biodiversity in the Andes. So this, if anyone would be interested in joining this initiative, that's it would be very nice to talk or discuss about this, because this is an ongoing work that we are trying to put more people together to work in this aspect that is really important. Well, I think that's it. Thank you very much.